This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
And he has his own inimitable way of taking even the uninitiated scientifically through complex scientific reasoning in a very clear and lucid way that enables one to put things into their correct perspective. So any of you that can make those lectures, it's highly recommended that you do so, and we're honored and happy to have with us Dr. Schroeder. Dr. Schroeder has been I'm welcoming him not just because he's a great scientist, because this is a shiur, one doesn't have to welcome great scientists to a shiur. I'm welcoming him in this way because of the contribution he's made to Kiddush Hashem, to sanctifying Hashem's name, both among Jewish people and among non-Jewish people all over the world, and the extent to which he has been Magdil Torah Ma'adiro, the extent to which he has elevated and raised the beacon of the Torah, something that's well appreciated. Before we go on to the fourth day, I want to just conclude the third day, that very difficult concept that we dealt with last week, and to make sure that that's well in place before we go further. We talked about the Maharal explaining that by the world being created, it had to be created in a way that wasn't 100% perfect. It had to have a lacking in order to need Hashem, so to say. There needed to be things that were absent. There needed to be imperfection in the world. And the world was created with very distinct and deliberate imperfections. And those imperfections in the Bria, those imperfections in the world, were responsible for the world at times not being able to translate God's will into action perfectly. Because of the imperfection, even the perfect will of Hashem is not translated into perfect expression. I guess if you looked at something through an imperfect lens, the fact that the object you're looking at is perfect, and the fact that your vision might be perfect, but because you're looking at it through an imperfect lens, the vision, the image will be an imperfect image. So it is, Hashem's will is perfect, but the world that was translating that will into action wasn't perfect. So when Hashem created the world out of nothing, that he could create exactly as he wanted to create it. But once the world existed and had its own dynamic, and the world was now generating its own production, the world was beginning to evolve under God's direction. Don't forget, Bria had taken place, the creation had taken place on the first day, and to this point we've had no further creation. It's all evolved out of that under God's direction. But already there's an imperfection in the way the world evolves. And the first area of imperfection that we see is actually reported in the Chumash, where God says, I want the trees. Eitz pri oise pri lemino. I want a tree that is fruit, to create fruit according to its type, according to its category. And then we're told in the next verse, in verse 12, Vatoitzeha oritz desheyes mazreaz elemeneu, v'eitz oise pri, and trees producing fruit, not fruit trees producing fruit. And Chazal say, because what God wanted was that the tree itself should be fruit and produce fruit. In other words, the tree should be edible and should have taste. And that's not what the earth produced. The earth produced trees as we have them, with one or two exceptions that are woody and do not have taste, but are able to produce fruit with taste. And we said the reason for that, as the Maharal explained it, is that the relationship of the tree to the fruit is similar to the relationship of Shomayim to Eretz, of heaven to earth. Heaven, we said, was a source of godly energy that fed the earth, that sustains the earth. The tree is a source of energy that sustains the fruit. And the earth, in producing this model, the model of the tree, which is a microcosm of the Shomayim v'Oretz relationship. So if you take the heaven and earth relationship, the spiritual and material relationship, and you see in the tree a microcosm of that relationship, a trunk, a tree that feeds and nourishes the fruit, produces the fruit, the earth decides to produce fruit that has an advantage over the tree, thereby ensuring that matter has an advantage over spirit. And that's what the tree of the earth does. In other words, the earth entrenches its position more strongly than was God's ideal intent, so to say. Now, of course, it's very difficult and one can go crazy thinking about it. What do you mean God's intent? God must have known that that's what the earth would do. Of course God knew that's what the earth would do. And nevertheless, God told us how he wanted it ideally. God didn't compromise his will because the earth couldn't fulfill it. God gives his will even though he knows the earth couldn't fulfill it. In the same way as Hashem gives us the mitzvahs, knowing that we can't keep them all. But it's not. There is no man who can be so righteous that does it all. So there's an acknowledgement on God's part that the ideal is not necessarily achievable. But that doesn't mean you compromise the ideal. The ideal has to stay in place. The ideal has to be uncompromised. The ideal has to be undiluted. And one has to try and aspire to the ideal. One has to try and get as far, as close as one can to the ideal. And so here too, in giving the instruction, God says how he wants it ideally. Ideally he wants the tree and the fruit to have the same taste. Ideally he wants the tree also to have the capacity of fruit. So that the fruit has no advantage over the tree except one. And that is the power of regeneration. The fruit contains the seed. So the fruit contains the power of regeneration. But in all other respects, God wanted the tree and the fruit to be governed by the same taste, by the same kind of matter, the same kind of material, and in its relationship to people to have the same kind of relationship. That's not what happens, and the earth decides to produce the model of a tree that has no taste. The taste is all in the fruit. So the fruit has an advantage. Not only does the fruit have an advantage, but we now have created a situation where sensuality is linked to the material, not to the spiritual. That's important to grasp this. That is, if we're going to take again the model of the tree as being the nourisher, which is the spiritual component, this is a masculine-feminine component as well, not in a sexist sense, but in the sense of the dynamic, the masculine-feminine dynamic. So you could look at Shamayim as masculine, Eretz as feminine, as the nourisher and the receiver. And and God is masculine and Klal Yisrael is feminine, and and here you're looking at the tree as the masculine, as the fruit, and the fruit as the feminine, that just as the male and the female forces. So you're getting the tree as nourisher and the fruit as the object being nourished. The tree as Shemayim, the tree as the source of spirit, the source of life, and the fruit as the matter nourished by that source of life. And that matter's compact. In one little fruit, you've got the seeds capable of regenerating several trees. So there's a lot of force in that little bit of matter. And that makes sense also in the whole relationship between energy and matter, that you can have a tiny particle of matter that is capable of releasing enormous amounts of energy. So we like to think of matter as being the weaker of the two, but it's not. Matter is energy packed into a very small package. And the fruit is a whole forest packed into a small package. So you can have these enormous trees, and you look at the fruit, and the fruit can have many seeds that are all capable of reproducing one enormous tree. So it's packaged in very small packages. That's what matter is. And the fruit is matter, which means now the earth, by giving taste to the fruit, not to the tree, has determined that man's sensual experience of reality can be gained only in the material world, not in the spiritual world. And that's not what God wanted. Ideally, God wanted man to be able to experience the spiritual world with the same sensuality that he can experience the physical world. That there wouldn't be that gap. That man would be able to synthesize the physical and the spiritual into one, and be able to experience physical and spiritual with his body and his soul. That he would be able to find sensuality in the spiritual and intellect and soul in the physical, and bring the two into total alignment. That was God's original intention. The earth couldn't do that. It wasn't possible for the earth to do that. So the earth, so to say, disobeys God and produces a tree that's the spiritual with a very tasty physical. So if you want to relate to the model sensually, you eat the fruit. You can't eat the tree. Sensuality can be found in the material world. It can't be found in the physical world. Now, if we take that a step further, it's important to see that regeneration, the capacity to regenerate, the capacity for reproduction, is all in the physical world, not in the spiritual world. The spiritual world doesn't allow for reproduction. the spiritual world doesn't allow for regeneration, because the essence of the spiritual world is God, and God is eternal, and God is infinite. God doesn't reproduce. He doesn't have children, contrary to what Christianity thinks. God doesn't have children, because God is spiritual. It is not in the nature of the spirit to be able to need, to reproduce, to regenerate. It starts off being perfect. Regeneration is a whole, that's the whole evolutionary process. It's an urge to try and survive, to try and become perfect, to continue. It's the way that a temporary being gains eternity, is through regeneration. But a spiritual being, an infinite being, doesn't need regeneration to gain eternity. The human being wants eternity. He's got to have children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. That's how he survives in eternity. But God doesn't need that. There would be a flaw in the spiritual if it needed to regenerate. So regeneration and reproduction belongs to the world of the physical, not to the world of the spiritual. Of course, God's intention was that they should be aligned, and we'll come to that later, but at the way the earth developed, they're not aligned. And regeneration falls into the area of the physical, of the physical and the material, which has important implications for the area of sexual relationships. That means there needs to be an understanding that the area of sexual relationships falls primarily into the physical area. It's a physical, sensual experience primarily. And it has to be recognized as that. And people get into all sorts of knots and problems when they try and spiritualize it. It's not a spiritual experience. It's a sensual experience. Now, just like with physical experiences like eating, which is also a physical experience, we introduce spirituality into it. But important is to see that when introducing spirituality, we don't detract from the sensuality. We're not meant to find less taste in the apple when we say a brocha. We're meant to find more sensuality in the apple. The saying of the brocha, the introducing of the spiritual, is meant to elevate not only the spiritual, but it's meant to heighten the sensual awareness also. You taste it in a different way. You appreciate it in a different way. That's what it's meant to be, and that's what it is if one says the brocha properly and with proper recognition of what it is, and one introduces the intellectual awareness into it, it opens the capacity for much greater sensual experience. Unfortunately, we don't practice our Yiddishkeit that way. We practice it like a formula. We practice it like a machine, and that detracts from what we do, and we'll still discuss that in great detail. But if the way it's meant to be, and if we just gave it the time to do it properly and naturally and comfortably and with pleasure, when a person makes a brocha, what should his face look like? Just think it. Don't think of the people's faces you've seen when they make brochas. Think to yourself, what should it look like? It should be relaxed. There should be a smile on the face from ear to ear. There should be a sense of joy and celebration. That's the facial expression on a person making a brocha. Have you seen people making brochas? Eyes screwed up. What kind of nonsense is that? Trying to turn something sensual into something spiritual, and you kill it both. It's not meant to be that way. A brocha is a celebration. It's linking the physical to the spiritual in a way that enhances not only the spiritual, but that enhances the physical also, that makes the sensuality more pleasurable, not less pleasurable. And that's how one actually increases sensual pleasure. There's a limit to how much sensuality one can gain just from the five senses. If you do something, if you taste an apple once, and you taste an apple a second time, and a third time, and a fourth time, you know, they're apples and they're apples, but at the end of the day, they're all apples. And how much pleasure can you get from apples? So we need variety. So we don't only eat apples, we eat grapes, and we eat figs, and we eat dates, and we eat all sorts of things as well to get some of that variety. But at the end of the day, how much variety? At the end of the day, we're going to need to be able to develop the capacity within ourselves to create variety in the same object because of the different colors, the different shades, the different senses of meaning that we can give it by the relationship that we have with it. So introducing the infinite into the sensual introduces the potential for infinite pleasure in sensuality. And that's what it's supposed to be. I'm talking to you about what it's supposed to be. I'm not talking to you about what it is. The bad news is that in most people's cases, what it becomes is that as you become more and more religious, your enjoyment of the world decreases proportionately. And that's a sign that we're doing something wrong. Shouldn't be that way. A religious person should be able to sense the world and enjoy the world and experience the world with far greater sensual intensity than the greatest hippie hedonist the world has ever produced. And that's how it is. And tzaddikim have told me that that is so. That is so. And I've told the story before, but it's a particularly appropriate here. When I was a young boy and I was sitting with Rebbe Lopian, And the Rebbe in Kfar Chassidim gave him a bowl of soup, and she gave me a bowl of soup. It was a nice bowl of soup, not as good as my mother used to make, but it was okay. And Rebbe Eliezer ate the soup, and he called her in, and he said, Rebbe, what soup? Fantastic, wonderful, beautiful. And my eyes nearly fell out of my head. This is the great Rebbe Lopian that I'd waited all my life to meet, and this is my first real meeting with him. I was sitting at his table, and the first thing I hear from him after Kiddush is how lovely the chicken soup is. So I was very young and cheeky at the time, so I thought I could afford to ask him the question. So I said to him, tell me, when the Rebbetzin was out, I said, that was really nice of you to say that. Obviously you didn't, the chicken soup is not the most important thing in your life. And he was nearly 90 at the time, or might have been 90 already. And he said to me, I'm 90 years old. I think he still said, I have one foot in the grave, and I'm blind in one eye. And when I taste chicken soup, I taste things in it that you can't possibly taste. That's how it is. Don't think it's just a spiritual thing. The taste is different. I experience things that are different. And the same rebellion, I've also told you the story, but it's appropriate, because it links into the same concept. When I went one Friday to him, I said, I'm going into Haifa, is there anything you need? And he said, you're going where? I said, to Haifa, down the road. He said, where did you say you're going? I said, to Haifa. And I said it a little louder. I thought he was hard of hearing maybe. He said, aren't you scared? I said, scared of what? I thought maybe a bomb had gone off, maybe there was a terrorist attack. I said, scared of what? And he said the same thing. He says, I'm 90 years old and I'm blind in one eye. I'm scared to walk in the streets of Haifa, the temptations. Rebbe Eliezer Lopian, the great rebellion, 90 years old, blind in one eye, scared of temptations. What's the reason? He's more sensually alert than a young yeshiva bocher is. That's the nature of a tzaddik. And that's why, kol ha-godol mi-chaveiro yitzro godol hemen. That as you get greater, the yetzer hara gets greater as well. One gets more tempted, not less tempted. As one becomes more spiritual, one is more sensually tempted, not less sensually tempted. And when a person finds himself becoming less sensually tempted, he knows he's not involved in the real thing. He knows he's killing himself, he's not developing himself. And there are countless examples of this, and countless areas where one sees that. The area of Yosef HaTzadik. Yosef is being sold by his brothers. Nearly died. He's been in that pit, you remember, with the snakes and scorpions. They pick him out of the pit. They sell him to the Ishmaelim. And they make a deal with him that he'll never contact the father. So here's this 18-year-old boy going off to Egypt, where there's not another Jew in sight. There's nobody he'll be able to talk to. Banned from ever contacting his family again. And Chazal tell us that the camels were carrying spices and perfumes. And the Chazal said, because normally those caravans of camels were carrying oils and hides. It was very unusual to be carrying spices in that part of the world. But the Chazal said, to teach us the miracle that Hashem cared for Yosef so much to make sure that he had a pleasant smell on the way down. And the Telzer Rav asks, is that what he's worried about? The tzaddik, Yosef, is going and he's worrying about his life and about his future and about never seeing his family again. Does it matter whether there's a pleasant smell or not on the camels? The answer is yes. Does to Yosef HaTzadik. Makes a big difference to have pleasant smells of perfumes and spices that he could enjoy, at least as it didn't stop his feeling of anguish, but at least there was a feeling of sensuality, there was a feeling of joy. That's sensual. When we make a havdalah, we've just made havdalah and we take a smell, we make a bracha, that's sensual. It's enjoying a smell. There are lots of things that we do that are sensual and that are meant to be sensual, and it's critically important. But to realize and to understand that if we're developing properly in Yiddishkeit, our sensual experience of the world should be greater. We should be developing the capacity for infinite sensuality. Whereas without Torah, we have limited sensuality. Without Torah, our only capacity for a new sensual experience is to do something different. And that's why people are going crazy, finding different things to do, because other things they've done already. And it's different foods, and it's different styles of cooking, and different styles of restaurants, and different places to travel to. And different forms of sexual experience, whether it's through changing partners or changing positions, and books and books and books being written to make it different, because you're doing the same thing over and over again. One has to be able to develop the capacity to find infinite sensuality in one's experience of life. And that's meant to be done through merging the spiritual and the physical into one. That was God's intention. And the earth messed it up for us. And the earth made the fruit the sensuality and the tree separate. So if you want to relate to the tree, you have to be a scientist. If you want to enjoy the sea, the tree, you use your brain, you use your head, you analyze it, you look at it, you observe it, you dissect it, you whatever you wish. If you want sensuality, if you want the joy of the taste, if you want to eat it, if you want to consume it, you've got to eat the fruit, you can't eat the tree. And so the earth creates the sensual experience in the material, not in the spiritual. Now, in the fourth day, we have another effort to try and get that right. Vayomer Elokim, and Hashem said, Yehi ma'oros b'rkiya ha'shamayim. Let there be lights in the atmosphere. Remember, we translated the rakiya as atmosphere. So he's created the atmosphere. Let there be lights in the atmosphere. Now, there's a lot of discussion in Chazal. Rashi brings some of it. Were the lights created in the beginning and simply positioned on this day? Were they there all the time and there was an inability of the light to penetrate the atmosphere, and so the earth wasn't getting any kind of benefit from the light, and Hashem removed that barrier so that the lights could penetrate the atmosphere? Or were they actually, did He evolve them? Was this all evolved on the fourth day and there wasn't anything there? They've been evolved from that original source of energy, but the lights as such weren't there. There are various different views in Chazal. Lahavdil bein hayoyim uvein halaylo, to separate between the day and the night. V'hoyu lo'isois ulamayadim ulayomim v'shonim. And these lights should be for signs, for Yom Tov, to measure days and to measure years. So what is their function? Signs, number one. Number two, they assist us in determining when Yom Tov is. Number three, in when it's day and when it's night, how long a day is. And number four, the years. These are different cycles that we need in order to function properly, different time cycles. And we use these lights in order to assist us in that process. The Vahayula also is that they should be as signs. Different views in Chazal. Some say it's signs as far as the days are concerned. But Rashi brings Loisus kishahama oirois loikin siman rohu loilo, says Rashi. That means that they are there to communicate to the world. When the lights get afflicted, it's a bad sign for the earth. Difficult to know what that means exactly, so sometimes it's taken to mean eclipses, although we don't see much sign of that in Chazal, that we're terribly worried about eclipses, because eclipses aren't really a pagam, they aren't really a disease of the light. The light isn't affected, it's just because there's a shadow in the way. But other kinds of issues, like as we had, when was it last year, was it Venus that got damaged a bit? Jupiter got damaged a little bit. Maybe that kind of thing, one doesn't know exactly what it means, but there's a message that the health of the lights have impact on us. Then v'hoyu limoiris birikiyah shumayim, and they will be lights in the heaven. And on that Rashi says, oid zois yishamshu shi'airu loilam. And in addition to that, they also give light to the world. Which means that in order of priority, their giving light to the world is not their first priority. As important as that is, and without the sun, where would we be? How would we function? Without any of them, without the stars also, we would be in some considerable difficulty. But with the sun, without the sun, where would we be? And yet, that's given almost as an afterthought. And additionally, in addition, says Rashi, they function as lights for the world. But that means they have another function which is just as important and separate from that. The Rav Deslich comments as part of what that function is the beauty. Just plain beauty. Part of the reason they're there is to give pleasure, because what kind of light do we get from some of the distant stars? We don't get much light from them. Light from the sun, we get light from the moon. Maybe we get light from some of the larger stars, but some of the very small stars that you've really got to look very carefully to even see, what are they there for? And Rav Deslich says just to be able to look up and see them and have satisfaction and fulfillment and excitement, and to understand the greatness of the creation through looking at them. For that alone, it was worthwhile for God to go through this enormous process of generating these beautiful stars so that we should be able to see them. Vayas Elokim es shnei ha-me'oros ha-gedolim, and Hashem made the two big lights, es ha-me'or ha-gadol le-memsheles ha-yom, ves ha-me'or ha-kotel le-memsheles ha-laylo, the big one to govern the day, and the little one to govern the night, the es ha-kechovim and the stars. And this pasuk causes a great deal of difficulty. Because in the first section of the verse it says, and God made the two big lights, and then he refers to the large one and the small one, the large one for the daytime, the small one for the nighttime. And there seems to be a contradiction between the first part of the pasuk and the second part of the pasuk. And important is the Maharal in Shavuos makes clear that since it says, Vayas Elokim Shnei Ha'Me'oros HaGedolim, when he made them equally big and equally powerful. We have the well-known Gemara. Rashi brings part of it, the Medrash brings it in a slightly different way. And the Gemara says in Chulin Daf Samach Amud Beis, Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi asked the question. It says, Vayas Elokim Shnei Ha'me'oros HaGedolim, God made the two big lights, Uchsiv Es Ha'me'or HaGadol Ves Ha'me'or HaKotom. And then it says, the big light and the small light, what's going on here? So he explains. Omro Yoreach Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The moon said before God, Ribbono shel Olam, Efshar lishnei melochim sheishtamshu bekeser echad? This is not right. Can two kings share one crown? The sun and I, we're of equal power, and this is no good. Omar lo, so God said to the moon, Lechi umati esatzmech, you're quite right, make yourself a little smaller. Omar lefonav, Ribbono shel Olam, hoyel v'amati lefonecha dovar hogun, amit esatzmi, because I said something which is true. You obviously acknowledge it's true, otherwise why are you telling me to get smaller? So you acknowledge that it's right, because I said something which is true, must I become small? Omar lo, so he said to her, Lechi umishol bayoyim uvalaylo. Yes, but there's a compensation, because you will sometimes appear in the daytime, sometimes you can see in the daytime, so you're better than the sun. The sun's only in the day, and you're in the day and the night. Amrele Mayra Vusa de Shraga Batiera, says the moon, thank you very much. And who'll even notice me in the daytime? What's the point of having a candle burning at midday? Can't see you, don't get any benefit from it. Amar lo, so he said to the moon, Zil Limdu Becho Yisrael Yomim Vashoni. Yeah, well, I'll give you another compensation. The Jews will use you for their calendar. So you're an important person. Amrele Yom Enami, Yevshad Eloi Manu Be Tikifuso. Says the moon, yeah, but they need the sun as well. You need to have a solar year, you need seasons. It's not as if they'll only use me, they use the sun as well. Says God, Zil likru tzadiki b'shmech. Tzadikim will be called after you. As we say, Yaakov hakoton, Shmuel hakoton, David hakoton. You'll see that people, the great people are called, not the great Shmuel, the great Yaakov, the great David, but the little David. The little Shmuel, the little Yaakov. So you see that the finest thing is to be small, not to be big. The good things are packaged in small parcels. Chazia deloi kamis vedaisa. God saw the moon wasn't accepting any of this. The moon was still very upset. Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu haviyu kaporo alai shemi atati es hayoreach. Bring an atonement for me that I caused the moon to become small. V'hayinu d'omer abishimim ben lakish manishtana se'ir shel rosh chodesh. You'll find that the sin offering brought on Rosh Chodesh is different to that brought on other Yom Tovs. Shene'emar bo'il la'Hashem, because when it says for the sin offering for Rosh Chodesh, it says la'Hashem, for God. Bring a sin offering for God. Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, se'ir ze yehe kapora al shemiyatati yis ha'yoreach. This se'ir, this goat that you bring as a sacrifice on Rosh Chodesh, is because I caused the moon to become small. Very difficult Gemara, this whole discussion. What is the dialogue between the moon and God, the relationship between the moon and the sun, and why does God at the end of it feel that he needs to bring a sacrifice? That if he did something wrong, why did he do it? And if it was wrong, why didn't he fix it? What's this? Every month he brings a sacrifice, or we bring a sacrifice for God. What is it all about? Let's look and see what's happening here. And let's try and use that same tree fruit model to understand this dialogue. The sun and the moon are originally created equal. What does that mean? We must say, therefore, that the moon was originally created as a source of light, just like the sun. It wasn't a reflector of light. It was originally created as a source of light, just like the sun. That was the original intention. Says the moon, that won't work. Can't have two sources. There has to be a relationship, there has to be a dynamic like the tree and the fruit. One has to nourish the other. And that's really important because in any relationship at any given time, roles can change, but at any one moment, one has to be giving and one has to be receiving. One has to be producing and one has to be supporting. There has to be a male-female relationship at any given time. Now, it doesn't mean that the male always plays the male role and the female always plays the female role. Sometimes they switch around. But at any one moment in any relationship, for the relationship to be non-competitive, there needs to be somebody playing a dominant role and somebody playing a supportive role so that the totality can stick together. You can only have a unity if you have a male and female dynamic taking place. In a two male or a two female dynamic, you can't have unity. And that's the moon's claim. The sun gives light and I give light and the sun in the day and I'm in the night. We're competing. Can't be. At the end of the day, there has to be a relationship between us. And one of us has to change in order to create that relationship. Clearly what the moon wanted was that the sun would change. So God reduces the moon to becoming a reflector. And what is introduced in that process of the moon becoming a reflector of light? So now we've got that dynamic. The sun gives, the moon receives. The sun nourishes, the moon produces. So we've got that tree and fruit relationship once again. They're relating to one another. There is a dependency. They need one another. Without the moon, there is no sunlight at night. Without the sun, there is also no sunlight at night. So the sun and the moon form a partnership to create light at night. Without either of them, it can't take place. And the sun nourishes the moon. Let's go back to the tree and to the fruit for a moment. An enormous risk occurs the moment the earth does what it did and produces fruit that has more taste than the tree. That means, as we said, that means that sensuality is linked to the material world, not to the spiritual world. If sensuality was linked to the spiritual world, then anything that tasted good would be good, and anything that wasn't good wouldn't taste good. Once sensuality is given independence of spirituality, it is possible to taste something that tastes good even if it isn't good. Are you with me on that? Very important to follow this through. If, as the original intention was, that there would be a complete alignment between the sensual and the spiritual, that would mean good things would taste good and bad things would taste bad. The way the earth produced itself, it deviated from that model, and now bad things can taste good and good things can taste bad, which introduces the possibility of error. Before that, there was virtually no possibility of error because people wouldn't eat things that didn't taste nice. People wouldn't do things that weren't pleasant. And by following that which is pleasant, they would simultaneously be doing that which is good. Now the way it's changed around, they can make a choice. Do I do what's good or do I do what's pleasant? So now dieting becomes an issue. And now what you're eating, the fact that it tastes nice doesn't mean it's good for you. All sorts of experiences. A nice, pleasant experience, but it's not good for you. So you've got to use a different method of reasoning to decide whether something's good for you or not. You've got to use science, you've got to use medicine, you've got to use all sorts of analyses to decide whether something's good for you or not. Whereas before, the intention was you could use your own intuitive sensuality to detect whether it was good for you or not. And of course, the big example of this is going to be the tree of knowledge that tasted beautiful, but wasn't good for them. And that wouldn't have been the case had the original model taken place. Then it would have been very clear. God creates sun and moon both as light givers. There was no matter in the heavens. Now, what we need to do here is a little bit of intellectual acrobatics, and we have to relate to Shomayim, skies, to the atmosphere, as an image of the spiritual world. Remember we said last week, I think it was, that as you move up, you're moving from the more material to the more spiritual. As the image will, the lower down you are, the more physical. The higher you go, the more spiritual. So when you look at the sun and the moon, you're looking at images of spirituality. Even though we know the moon's a big rock, but as far as we're concerned, they are used as images of spirituality. In that case, the image God wanted was that in the world of spirituality, there wasn't a male-female relationship. You could have the two suns working together, operating as one, and in a non-competitive situation, which meant you didn't need matter. What happens after the moon complains? God changes the moon from being a source of energy into being a rock, into being matter that reflects the sun. So God introduces matter into the world of spirituality. Okay? A very important thing. So now the boundary line between the material and the spiritual is becoming a little confused. In the upper world, we've now got matter, we've got a moon, whereas beforehand we only had stars, we only had energy, we only had fire. Now all of a sudden we've got plain matter, rocks up there. And down at earth we've got spirituality. So there's a crossing of the boundary lines. And now we've got matter up there. What about the possibility for error? At least beforehand, although there was a possibility of error in the way we related to the physical world, because I might eat a fruit that's not good for me, because it tastes nice. So if we have sensuality attached to the material world, we had the possibility of error in the material world, but not in the spiritual world. In the spiritual world, there was no matter, and therefore sensuality was directed at the spiritual. Now what happens with the moon becoming a rock? What now happens? Are we introducing the possibility of error into Shomayim, into the spiritual world too? Let's examine that for a moment. Omar Rabbi Azaria b'shem Rabbi Chanino, lo nivro lahair elo galgal chamo bilvad. Even the original intention was that only this light giver. Im kein lama nivres levono. So why did God create the moon? Elo melamed shetzofa HaKadosh Baruch Hu shorasidim oivdei kechovim la'asoyson elohus. Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, ma im mishehen shnayim machishin zed ze oivdei kechovim la'asoyson elohus. Ilu ayo echod alachas kama v'kama. Says the Medrash, God foresees that people are going to start worshipping the stars and the lights. Says God, if when there are two of them, God, people are worshipping them, can you imagine what will happen if there was only one? That means God's original intention in creating sun and moon was just that there shouldn't be one source. Because the one source is God. And once you come to the material world, there should be more than one. So that nobody can make the mistake, and have the error of perceiving the sun to be the only source of life, and therefore seeing the sun as a God. That's why God made the sun and the moon. It says, Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz, it appears from here, that the moon introduces the possibility of error. And let's understand that a little bit. Possibility of error in the spiritual world. What did the moon introduce? The moon introduced illusion into the world. That's what it did. It was the first time that you could look at something and what you saw wasn't real. It was the first time that you could look there and you would see a slice of moon, but the fact is the moon is round. The fact is, you can only see, that's your perception, as we said in the ladies' shiur this morning. That's your perception. And perception and reality are no longer in sync. That was the first time that that happened. Up until then, perception and reality were in sync. Now, if God's intention with the fruit would have been carried out, then there would have been total sync. There would have been total alignment. That whatever you perceived as pleasant was also good. Now that the earth produced its own thing, you were able to perceive something good tasting that wasn't good. So there's already a possibility for error in the physical world. But the intention was, at least when you looked up to heaven, there would be no mistake. You look at the sun, you see the sun, it's a ball of fire. That's what it is. You can feel the heat, you can see the light, you're seeing reality as it really is. You're looking at a star, you're looking at a ball of fire burning. That's what it is. After God reduced the moon, you don't know what you're seeing anymore. You look and you see a slice, but it's really round. You're not seeing what you're seeing and what is reality are two different things, even in the spiritual world. And so the possibility of error is introduced with the moon. The possibility of making a mistake even in spirituality. Now we're really in trouble. Because now you can't trust your senses in the physical world. They might be wrong. And you can't even trust your senses in the spiritual world, because they might also be wrong. And the proof is, look at the moon and tell me what you see. And I'll prove to you that what you see bears no resemblance to reality. Reality is different to what you see. And that was what was created with the moon. The possibility of error even in our relationship to spiritual things. And therefore God says, bring a sacrifice for me. Because I had to introduce into the spiritual world the possibility of error. This is now the source of spiritual error, of avodah zarah, of idolatry, of believing in falseness, of not understanding the Torah correctly, of seeing illusions of what the Torah is meant to be, which isn't what it really is. All of this came about as a result of a lack of clarity in the heavens that was equal to the lack of clarity down here. In both cases, what you sense is not necessarily what is. After the earth produced trees and fruit that weren't aligned, you could taste something delicious that wasn't good. Now you could see something as a semicircle when in fact it's a full circle. And in fact, to link that up to what we did in the late issue this morning, this explains to some degree the very strange process that used to be followed for the declaration of Rosh Chodesh. During the time of the temple, Rosh Chodesh could take place either 30 days or 31 days after the previous Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh is the new moon. So, and a lunar month is 28 and a half days. So the month is either 29 and a half days. 29 and a half days. So the month is either 29 days or the month is 30 days. If the month is 29 days, Rosh Chodesh is on the 30th day. If the month is 30 days, Rosh Chodesh is on the 31st day. And we showed in the late issue this morning how the way that the new moon used to be declared and how they knew whether it was on the 30th day or the 31st day was that witnesses used to have to come. Because the moment you could see the first little slice of moon, that was Rosh Chodesh. So witnesses used to come to the Beis Din in Yerushalayim and they used to be cross-examined and they used to be asked exactly what they saw. And if two witnesses could be satisfied the Beis Din that they had seen the new moon, the Beis Din would declare the month Rosh Chodesh, would declare Rosh Chodesh. However, what is interesting we showed was that the Beis Din had the formulas, the scientific and mathematical knowledge to predict Rosh Chodesh down to virtually the second. They knew astronomically exactly at what moment Rosh Chodesh was. They didn't need witnesses. So much so that if they worked out that Rosh Chodesh was on the 31st day, and witnesses came on the 30th day and said, we saw the moon. They didn't even cross-examine them. They just threw them out as false witnesses. There was no question that they would not accept evidence that countered their scientific calculation in which they had 100% confidence. And the question we asked was, if they had 100% confidence in their scientific calculation, so much so that if a witness came and said, we saw the moon on a day that they knew it couldn't be, they threw the witnesses out, why need the witnesses altogether? What is their role? What is their function? If you can work it out so totally, what do you need the witnesses for? And we talked this morning about the need to align empirical information with experiential information. There are two ways that we have a feeling as to what the world is around us. The one is what we see and feel, sense, and the other is using our brains to work it out. And very often what we see and what we feel and sense and what our brains tell us are not aligned. So the examples we gave is if you sit and sunbathe on the beach from morning till evening and you watch the sun rise on the east and set on the west, what have you seen? What have you experienced? You've experienced the movement of the sun from the east right across the sky, across the zenith of the heavens, down to set in the west. You saw it. But you know empirically that the sun didn't move at all. It was you who was moving, not the sun. So there you've got a case of where your sensual experience of the world is counter to your empirical knowledge of the world. And there are many such examples. In the case of Rosh Chodesh, there are two different experiences of the new moon. The one is you can calculate scientifically exactly when that new moon has to be there, and the other is you can see it. Somebody can see it, look up in the sky, and there's the new moon. What we like for Rosh Chodesh, certainly when we declare Rosh Chodesh on the 30th day, is to bring those two experiences into alignment. And only if we've got them in alignment do we declare Rosh Chodesh. We don't rely only on the empirical knowledge, and we don't rely only on the witnesses. If the witnesses tell us that our empirical knowledge is accurate, although we know it's accurate, we're able to declare the month Rosh Chodesh. And I explained why that was. And I said, and I'm going to repeat it very, very briefly because we spent a lot of time on it this morning. What I said this morning is that information and enthusiasm are two very different qualities. Information is fact, and enthusiasm is emotion. And what used to drive the world was enthusiasm. What is beginning to drive the world is information. And that has very, very serious implications in many different areas. And we discussed some of the implications of an information-driven world. We talked about the impact that has on competitiveness. That if the world is driven by information, then you, as a customer, are going to make your purchasing decisions on the basis of information, not on the basis of enthusiasm. Which means the only way I can sell my products to you is if, based on the information I can give to you on a computer screen, you are satisfied that what I'm providing you with is as good as my competitor but a little cheaper, then you will buy it. But if it's not as good or it's not cheaper, you will not buy it. There will not be an emotional component into that purchasing decision, which means my only competitive advantage is to be cheaper than anybody else. And of course that creates a situation where people are driving themselves totally mad, because you make it cheaper and then your competitor makes it cheaper and then you make it still cheaper and they make it cheaper, and you're just running around each one trying to be a little bit more efficient than the guy before, which means you have to work harder and harder with less and less resources in order to be able to achieve the same output for a lesser input, and at the end of the day you die. You get disease, you get ill, and you die. That's what it is. This is one of the things that is causing an environment in which we're operating in which people will not be able to survive. It won't be able to be. Whereas if you're able to use enthusiasm for the purchase, then I can bring you I can drive a beautiful motor car outside your house, and I can say to you, come and look at this. Just come and look at it. And I show you and I say, sit inside it, see what it feels like. And you sit and you feel, and I say, take it for a drive. And you take it for a drive around the block, and you're already saying, you say, how much does it cost? And I say, you know, well, it costs 150,000 rand, but for you, I can work something out. Let me see what I can do for you. We're already negotiating. You're not shopping around. You're not shopping around. What's creating the sale? The enthusiasm. Where enthusiasm is one of the components, you don't have to be the cheapest. Not necessary, as long as you're creating enthusiasm. That used to be the role of the salesman. The salesman used to have to create enthusiasm. The teacher used to have to create enthusiasm. The rabbi used to have to create enthusiasm. Once there's enthusiasm, people can direct themselves to do all sorts of things with that enthusiasm. And now we're moving into an information age, where everybody speaks in dull monotones, merely conveying the information accurately and correctly so that you're in a position to make your own decisions without any sense of enthusiasm. And people are beginning to talk that way, people are beginning to write that way, people are beginning to communicate that way. It's a communication of information, not a communication of energy and enthusiasm. In the case of Rosh Chodesh, when they declared Rosh Chodesh on the 30th day, it wasn't just a declaration in terms of information. Today is Rosh Chodesh. That wasn't the issue. They could have done that by circularizing. They were able to calculate when in advance, well in advance. They could have told everybody well in advance. Next month is going to be a 29-day month. The 30th day is going to be Rosh Chodesh. That's all. That wasn't the issue. They communicated a sense of Kedusha Sachodesh. They communicated a sense of sanctity on that 30th day. And to communicate enthusiasm, sanctity, emotion, you need to be exposed to real experience. You can't be exposed to information and get excited. Information doesn't excite. Information doesn't enthuse. Information gives mental stimulation, but people are confusing mental stimulation with enthusiasm. Enthusiasm comes from the ability to synthesize the sensual with the spiritual. When you can take the spiritual component and you can take the sensual and you can create one package that contains them both, then you've got enthusiasm. Then you've got something to truly get excited about. And that's why we spoke about the various different forms of communication, whether it's cinema as opposed to theater. whether it's electronic music as opposed to a live performance. All of these are very important in what they communicate. Not just information, not just sounds, but a complete package of sensuality wrapped in together with overtones of spirituality. That can enthuse, that can create real excitement in people and motivate people into action. Actually generate in people the capacity to act, the capacity to do. So comes Rosh Chodesh. Since Rosh Chodesh was the day that introduced the potential for error, by separating illusion, perception from reality, even in the physical world, we try to reunite perception and reality on Rosh Chodesh. And the Beis Din sits and waits for their scientific, empirical information to be confirmed by a real human being who was standing outside under the sky and looked up and saw the moon. And when we get such a real human being, two of them, that come and talk to us about their experience, and they tell us exactly where they saw it and what it looked like and what the angle was, and we question, we enter into dialogue with them, and that confirms the empirical information, then we're able to align the empirical information and the sensual experience, and we'll be able to rectify on Rosh Chodesh that which deteriorated with the creation on the moon. And then we bring that sacrifice and we, so to say, atone for Hashem. We say, God, it's okay, relax. We've been able to align it again. We've been able to bring it together again and to create that complete package of sensuality and spirituality. That's the avodah of Rosh Chodesh. That's the job. That's the work. That's the art, the skill of a Rosh Chodesh to try and achieve that. What's important in this appreciation is that this illusion that is created in the moon is also responsible for the term for a month. For the month we now call Chodesh. Chodesh comes from the word Chadash, which is new. And Chazal, and we brought it in a shir some months ago when we talked about the Hischadshus, that one is expected to renew oneself. Chazal says, the Medrash says, Tischadshu kalavono, become new like the moon. And you remember I posed the question, there's nothing as sterile as the moon. It's so strange that the image of newness, of regeneration, of refreshment, is the moon, when there's nothing so sterile. If you went up to the moon now, you'll find Neil Armstrong's footprint in the same place that he left it 30 years ago. Nothing changes there. It's a piece of rock that doesn't change. The sun changes. The earth changes. The stars change. They grow. They get smaller. Things happen. With the moon, nothing happens. It's the one heavenly body that just experiences no change at all. And yet this is our image of Hischadshus. And I explain because the Torah wants to teach that Hischadshus, renewal, doesn't come from the object. Renewal comes from the subject. That's back to what we were saying earlier. That if one is able to align the spiritual with the physical, the reason the moon looks new is not because the moon has changed. The moon is exactly the same as it was 2 weeks ago, 1 week ago, and in 2 weeks' time. There's no change at all. We're standing in a different position. The earth has shifted. And the relationship between the earth and the moon has changed. The angles have changed. And because we've changed our position vis-a-vis the moon looks different. And that's the lesson. You can look at the same thing from different perspectives and it looks new and it looks different. That's that infinite sensuality that can be introduced by being able to move yourself, to refresh in yourself, to change your perspective, not to become rooted in one position that you can never move out of. Take a different look. Look at it from a different perspective. Experience the same world from different angles and see what will happen. See the change in what you see, the change in what you feel. That's the meaning of Hischadshus. That's the way one can create that novelty. So yes, novelty, newness is in the material world. The material world is where you've got new things. Not the spiritual world. In the spiritual world, there's nothing new. There's one God who was always there and always will be there. In the physical world, you've got regeneration. You've got creation and recreation and procreation. That's all in the physical world. And the moon is a physical object up in the spiritual heights. It's a piece of matter up in the heavens. And that comes the closest to bringing into alignment the spiritual and the physical in a way where if we shift our position each night, we're able to look at that same piece of matter and see something very, very different. That's the art of Hischadshus. That's the art of regeneration. That's the art of revitalization. That's the art of recreation, which forms an essential part of the Rosh Chodesh.